Today's featured guest, the head of WolfStreet.com. Welcome back, Wolf Richter.
Thanks for having me back, Chris.
You know, it's a pleasure to have you. And obviously, a lot going on in California today. Some serious fires there in the, I believe it's Redding area, as well as, correct me if I'm wrong, Mendocino?
Mendocino, yeah. There's a three-county fire, so it has spread over. It's called the Mendocino Complex Fire. But it's really covering three counties, and it is, in terms of surface area, by far the largest fire in California's recent history. So, it's fire season. We have two seasons in California, you know, rainy season, if it's raining, and fire season. And fire season seems to come earlier, and it's just ferocious these last 2 years.
Exactly. They're showing maps I've seen on CBS and other stations where an area so large that covers considerably more than New York City. This is a real tragedy.
Yeah, I'm not talking right now. There are over 300,000 acres in that one, in the Mendocino Complex fire that has been burned down. So far, in terms of lives lost this year, it's bad, you know, but it's not quite as bad as last year. But the fire season just started. It's just the beginning, you know. It's going to go into October, November, probably, depending on when the rainy season starts. And a lot of these fires are probably not going to completely die down until the first rains are coming.
There's a lot of misconceptions surrounding the issue. We've heard talk about how, well, they've diverted too much water to the sea and whatnot. But in reality, local officials have confirmed that there is ample water to fight these fires. One of the big issues, other than obviously the dry vegetation and whatnot, overgrowth. They haven't had the opportunity to cut back the foliage. And as a result, there's plenty of tinder to fan the flames. Add to that, as you say, the seasonal factors and the arid conditions. But, you know, really our thoughts and prayers go out to California because this is becoming a huge issue. Even those who haven't lost their lives or their homes have been displaced. I mean, they're having to evacuate, as I'm sure you've seen, entire communities. Looking through your great Wolf Street site, and one of the things that catches the eye right off is your GDP review. You know, we saw some big numbers last week, 4.1 revised in the latest monthly. Your analysis seems to indicate that the GDP is likely somewhat off kilter. Can you tell us more, please?
The headline GDP number that we're looking at in the United States is really a very volatile number that you or maybe no other country uses. We're looking at a GDP growth rate from the prior quarter. So in Q2, it was a growth rate from Q1, so the change, but annualized, so essentially multiplied by four. You know, these numbers are extremely volatile, and I posted a chart to show this. It goes, during the financial crisis, this quarterly change annualized, so multiplied by four, really went to almost minus 9% in one quarter. Now, in Q2, it hit 4.1%, but under, you know, we've been over 4.1%, over 4%, over 4.1%, several times during the period since the financial crisis, higher actually. Four times we were above that rate under the Obama administration. So this is Trump's first 4-plus GDP number. And because this number is so volatile, it reverts to the mean. The reversion to the mean can be brutal. It can be followed by a series of very lousy GDP reads. So what I like to look at is the more standard, in the globally speaking, way of measuring GDP growth, and that's the actual annual growth. So in the second quarter compared to the second quarter a year ago. And that's the normal GDP figure that is being cited. It's the annual GDP growth. That was 2.8%. And that's pretty good. You know, that's nothing to sneeze at compared to where we've been. But it's not out of range. We've had those growth rates in prior quarters, but it's at the upper end, at the upper range, you know, of where we've been since the financial crisis. And we've been as low as 1.6% and as high as 3.8% since the financial crisis. So this is in the upper range, and it's good. I mean, the economy is good, but it's not growing at a 4.1% annual rate. I mean, that's second quarter annualized. So I essentially multiply it by four, and that's a mean reverting number. And we'll see a reversion to the mean over the next few quarters.
You know, when we talk about reversions to the mean, generally economists look for 2 to 3 quarters back-to-back of negative GDP growth before calling a recession. Our policymakers tend to be the last to know. They're looking more in the rearview mirror as far as the potential for an economic downturn. What is your analysis? Do you have a projection or even a forecast on whether or not you see in 2019 a slowdown or perhaps even a recession?
Definitely in 2018, I don't see a recession. I mean, I don't think that's happening this year. So that's, for me, that's off the table. I mean, we could have some kind of crisis that would trigger the beginning of a recession in 2018, but I just don't see that happening. 2019, I think, has a considerable probability of a recession. You know, I don't see any data right now to forecast a recession in 2019. Right now, the goods-producing economy in the United States is very strong, and it has been through a recession in 2015, 2016. That's not the service sector. That's the goods-producing sector. And we've seen transportation decline substantially during that period. In the service sector, you know, it held up, but the GDP growth in 2016 was 1.6% because of the recession in the goods-producing economy. Right now, the goods-producing economy is really strong. And so we've seen pricing and freight surge. There's a truck shortage. Railroads are happy. It's really hard to get things shipped on time right now because inventories are being filled up and growing backlogs. And so the goods-producing economy is really strong. But that's a very cyclical part of the economy. And I don't know where the peak is of that cycle, but we may be close to it. And then once that cycle trends lower, you know, you'll have a slowdown in the goods-producing sector. That may still not produce a recession, but it's going to slow down the economy to some extent. And if it coincides with a slowdown in the service sector, that's when you'll get a recession. The service sector is bigger, so that's really the thing to watch. The service sector includes housing. Housing is still strong. Construction, I mean, the rents are, that's part of the service sector. Construction is part of the goods producing sector. So rents are still rising. The whole housing industry, finance, all that is still strong. But that's, yeah, that's being targeted by the Fed. So the Fed's trying to take some of the exuberance out of these asset prices. And it is named commercial real estate, which is apartments, among other things, specifically housing, complaining about and in some situations being elevated and so forth. So the Fed is targeting some of those sectors. We have not seen any impact yet of that targeting. The markets have brushed that off. But this is going to eventually sink in, and this may happen in 2019, and then we'll see a slowdown in the service sector, perhaps combined with a slowdown in the goods-producing economy. And that would make a noticeable impact. It could trigger what then will be an official recession.
I'd like to keep with that thought with the real estate and housing sector. Wolf Street does a great job keeping an eye on the Case-Shiller housing indexes, and you'd like to break it down city by city. Seattle, Boston, Chicago, many others. So let's talk about your latest article here on the topic, The Most Splendid Housing Bubbles in America, posted July 31st. I'd like to give you a chance to break down some of the cities that you think are in bubble territory.
There's different ways of reporting home prices, and the Case-Shiller index is one of those, and it's very peculiar and different from other measures in that it measures the price changes of the same home as it's being sold over time. So when a house was sold in 2012 and then it gets sold in 2018, the Case-Shiller measures that difference and it uses algorithms to adjust that and come up with its index. So it's not a median price index. It measures sales pairs. And so in that respect, it's very different. And it gives a little bit of different results than when we look at median prices. And it lags behind. So it lags about 3 months or so behind. So what we're looking at is what happened in terms of the housing market a few months ago. And it's not what's happening today. In this respect, the Case-Shiller has a national index. It's very strong. It rose 6.4% for that month compared to a year ago. Yeah, that 6.4% goes across all the cities that it measures. Or really, it measures metropolitan areas. In terms of San Francisco, for example, it measures a five-county area around San Francisco. It's never just a city in Dallas and in L.A. and all these cities. You know, it measures the metroplex around it. So there's a very broad-based index. And the national index combines those city indexes that it has. And 6.4% increase year over year is pretty significant when you think about, you know, wages rising at less than half that rate. And that's been the case for many, many years, that home prices have outgrown wages. Now, people say we should adjust this for inflation, but yeah, a home price index like this is a measure of inflation. It's a measure of asset price inflation, specifically of housing inflation. So it measures, these houses don't get bigger. You know, the same house doesn't get bigger or more valuable. The in that sense, like a company sales grow, you know, and then it will become more valuable as its profits go up. A home that you live in doesn't grow. And so when the price goes up, it's a sign of asset price inflation. And that's what this index measures. In some cities, and so this, the national index was high, you know, 6.4% increase. That's pretty strong. In some cities, particularly in Seattle, we have a spike going on that is just dizzying. When you look at the chart, I mean, the chart goes back to about 2000, you know, that spike is just of the last few months. It's just incredible. And it is like from month to month as well as 2%. I mean, that's a very strong rate in terms of annual growth. It's up 14% from a year ago. It's now up 34% from the peak of the prior housing bubble. So this is measuring from the peak of the bubble to the current prices. And you know, we called the prior housing bubble a housing bubble for a reason. You know, afterwards, after it collapsed, you know, we said it wasn't sustainable. It was now the new normal is like, oh, well, that's a period of stability compared to where we are today. So in Seattle right now, the home prices are, according to the Case-Shiller, 34% higher than they were above peak of the prior housing bubble. In Denver, it's 53% higher than the peak of the prior housing bubble. In Dallas, it's almost 50% higher. And in some other cities like Atlanta, which had enormous house price increases during the prior housing bubble, and then huge plunges, the current are just above the prior bubble. So in Atlanta, it's 7% above the prior peak right now. Angeles, which had another incredible housing bubble. You know, when you look at the chart, it's just like a sugar cone. You know, the home prices more than doubled from 2002 to the peak of 2006, I mean, just shot up and then collapsed. I brutally collapsed and then had a bottoming out process and then started rising again. And now they're 3% above that incredible peak during the prior housing bubble. So every one of these major cities that I looked at has now exceeded the peak of the prior housing bubble in terms of the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. In San Francisco, you know, we're 40% above the prior peak. And the prior peak, I mean, that was an incredible period.
Your Case-Shiller work on Dallas, 47% above the peak. And if we do peak to trough, 50%. What's driving this? I mean, obviously, there's record demand. If we turn back to 2006 to 2007, I think it was really obvious that we would have a downturn. You had the Altays, the Ninja loans. Anyone who could fog a mirror could get a loan. What's driving this market today? We don't see that subprime question mark, or do we? Because you've had some unique thoughts in this area. That subprime is still lurking behind this market.
There's subprime lending out there, but in terms of the banks, you know, that's where the problem was last time. In part, you know, there were non-bank lenders that collapsed very quickly, and they were allowed to collapse. But a big part of the subprime lending was handled by the big banks last time. That's not happening this time. The subprime lending these days, the big banks have become fairly prudent with that. Their loan underwriting is pretty strong. They've learned somewhat of a lesson, I would think. But the subprime lending has moved off to non-bank lenders, and so they're not regulated as heavily or not regulated at all in that respect. Those are the ones that were allowed to collapse without question last time. And there were several of them. You know, they just fell apart. Now, Quicken Loans has become the largest mortgage lender in the country. So that's a non-bank lender and is not regulated and is now outgrown Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo used to be the largest mortgage lender, and Quicken Loans, in part because of the subprime lending and the very aggressive online lending and their underwriting standards that are not nearly as strong. And we have a whole slew of other non-bank lenders, and these are the shadow banks.
That's what I wanted to get to, because I think we've discussed this maybe via email. A lot of what may be occurring here is HUD and some of the other major lenders, the federal authorities, for the most part, have taken over the reins. Now it really is the government that's underwriting much of this bubble this time around. I'd like to know whether or not you see that as a potential Achilles heel to put the taxpayer even further at risk during the next downturn.
In terms of much of the subprime lending is not government guaranteed. Now, there are some aspects of subprime lending, and the VA, you know, and other organizations guarantee some smaller numbers in terms of subprime. There will be some hits. You know, the government will take, the government meaning the government-sponsored enterprises, Ginnie Mae is part of the government, so they will take a hit. But it won't be as catastrophic on subprime as we might think. I think the biggest hit will be taken by these non-bank lenders that, you know, they can't necessarily sell their mortgages, the subprime mortgages, especially to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So a lot of them have to raise their funds in other ways, and some of them is bank lending, so they go to the largest banks and get large loans from them. And they also do asset-backed securities. So the risk from these shadow banks is actually spread out. And that's good. And for the taxpayer, that's good. You don't want to be backing these shadow banks, but it's in investors' portfolio. The risk is sitting in pension funds and in bond funds, and it's sitting on bank balance sheets, spread among many banks now, but it's dispersed. So the risks are more on the investor side this time, I think, than on the taxpayer side.
I'd like to illustrate San Francisco, which you led off with, from trough all the way to the recent peak. So we're talking maybe 2009, 2010, up to the current levels. That's a 70% or ascent from those low levels. Is this sustainable? Is this a new paradigm? Have we reached a permanent plateau, as Fisher said? As you said earlier, a return to the mean at some point.
San Francisco is a boom and bust town. All of California is, but San Francisco in particular, that was bred into the economy during the gold rush, and it has not disappeared. And everybody here knows this. So if you look at median prices, so going away from the Case-Shiller, but going to median prices, median house prices have more than doubled from the trough. So that's 100%, over 100% increase in those 10 years, really 8 years. Trough was in 2011, so it's really 7 years. And that's a huge, huge increase. And there is no plateau in San Francisco ever on anything. And I know a lot of people in real estate, commercial real estate, as well as residential real estate, and people that have been in this business for 20-plus years, they say this feels worse in that sense of frothier than it did in 1999. San Francisco's economy essentially collapsed in 2000 because the employership, employees, and people left. It was too expensive, and San Francisco emptied out. And there's a lot of people leaving and lots of empty apartments. This didn't really happen in 2008, 2009, because the bailouts were so strong and so quick, and the money from you know, venture capital and so forth started flooding into San Francisco very quickly. But in 2000, that didn't happen. And there was a long period where people just left, and apartments stood empty and prices dropped, and office space stood empty and prices dropped. And that was a real bust, you know, the kind that nobody really wants to live through. And the people that have been in this business for a long time, they said, today, this is even frothier than it was in 99, and they expect a downturn perhaps worse than what for San Francisco, you know, than what we're seeing. Because it's so expensive, people lose their jobs. They can't stick it out here. They have to leave, you know. You can't, you know, if you pay $3,000 a month for a tiny little apartment and you lose your job and you've got a few thousand dollars in the bank, pretty soon you realize, I get out of here. You know, I got to go back home, go knock on mom's door and see if she let me in. And this is what's happening in San Francisco regularly when, you know, when the economy, the local economy turns south and some of the venture-funded companies are letting people go. And if that happens, they leave. They don't have roots here. They'll leave. And that happens very quickly. You know, they once they're laid off and they decide they can't stay here, you know, they're gone. And then you'll see a bust in the housing market and probably in the office market of the type probably that we saw in 2000 through 2004, in that range. And people have been in this business for a long time. They expect this. They now openly talk about it. They just don't know when it will happen, but they say this is going to happen again. This is boom and bust, and right now we're somewhere near the peak of the boom, and it can't go on much further.
Obviously, the Fed could likely be winding down its rate increases. We're looking for maybe one more increase in September and perhaps another in December. At the same time, you know, the EU economic ministers are looking to likely increase rates and curtail their quantitative easing. We're also hearing in Asia. It might just put the U.S. dollar in a less favorable position as soon as early 2019. Do you see that as at least a little better for the precious metals?
Yeah, precious metals are an incredibly frustrating investment right now, have been for years, as we all know. I have trouble relating the dollar to gold, for example. You know, they seem to move in different ways, especially the last few years. But I know that, having been in this for enough decades, that cycles with precious metals are very, very long. An up cycle can last 10 years or more, and down cycles can last as long or longer. And I've been through that. I mean, the first big loss I've had was in silver, which I bought in the early 1981 or something like that, after it had collapsed by 30 or 40%, you know, and I thought, okay, this is a great time to buy. And then a year later, or a year and a half later, I sold it at a 50% loss. And it continued to lose money into the 2000s. And it's now back where it was when I bought it in 1981. These cycles are horribly long when you're on the wrong side of it. And it's very frustrating. And you have to have an enormous amount of patience. And, you know, I own some silver. And to me, it's something that I own, period. And I don't even pay any attention to whether it goes up or down because, you know, it's the metal I own. And that's what you have. And I don't expect any major change in direction in gold and silver in 2019. I just don't think we're long enough into the down cycle. I mean, there's going to be ups and downs like we've seen in the past few years, but in terms of the long-term trend, you know, we're just a few years into this, and I just don't see the cycle turning. You know, it may go up 15 or 20%, and then it'll go back down, and it may hit, it may carve out a new decade low, you know. And I think people into precious metals have to be accepting of this. The people who do day trading and the futures market, you know, that's a different story. But if you own the metal, the long-term cycles is really something that you have to accept. And if you accept them, you know, it's not that frustrating because you know they're there. And when the next up cycle comes, it will last a very long time also. You don't really, it's hard to time, and you just own the metal and enjoy it and wait for the next big up cycle without too much frustration. That's how I look at it. I just don't expect a big upturn next year in precious metals.
You know, another market pretty well correlated with the precious metals is obviously U.S. equities. As long as investors continue to pour funds really on a global basis into U.S. stocks and shares, and that obviously is going to diminish any interest in safe haven assets, and precious metals top that list. As we wrap up, anything you'd like to share with the listeners, maybe some topicality that I haven't brought up today?
I want to point out that one really important thing that I stress on my website, which is the transportation sector, particularly trucking and railroads. And if you want to get a feel for how the goods-producing economy is doing, look at trucking. And trucking is on cloud nine right now. Truck orders, heavy truck orders, hit an all-time record. They're up by close to 200% from a year ago in terms of demand for trucks. And it follows an incredibly strong increase for shipping goods across the country. This is something we need to keep our eyes on. You know, the goods-producing sector in the U.S. economy is doing extremely well right now, and everybody on the inside is already saying, this cannot last like this. You know, we cannot move further. Or in terms of the economy looking forward, the trucking sector is something that we can use as a thermometer, and right now it's as hot as it's ever been. And when that turns, I think we'll get the first major signal that there may be a slowdown coming.
This must be one of the most hated markets, at least bull markets, in U.S. equities that we've ever seen.
It's extremely overvalued. I mean, that's part of the problem. After 8 years of bull market, the shares are overvalued. I mean, the economy is strong, but the shares are overvalued.
The charts will give you a nosebleed, but I will keep an eye on transportation. Do you have any hypotheses as to why trucking is so red hot now?
But there's a lot of theories out there, and part of it is the investment tax credit. Companies have moved their investments forward to benefit from that. The fear of tariffs could be a possibility. The cycles of the goods-producing economy is a very cyclical part of the economy, and it went through a recession in 2015, 2016. It came out of that recession in 2017, and now we're in the boom cycle, and it's going to go back into a recession at some point in the future. But the boom cycle is exaggerated. I mean, it's not. How this is going, and inventories are building up. Now, that's part of the boom cycle. When inventories get too heavy, you know, people cut back the orders, that brings on the recession. But right now, inventories are building. The companies have trouble getting the merchandise, so there's this kind of scramble going on, you know, to hire trucks to get your merchandise shipped, and everybody's trying to speed everything up because the delays are there. So I know it's going to take me a week longer to get my merchandise shipped, I'm going to bring the orders forward. It has that sort of mentality to it that you get in very frothy periods, and that's what's happening in the trucking sector right now. And it's just incredible. And it can't last. You know, these things cannot last. They're self-correcting, and we will see that. We'll see that probably later this year, and I'll make sure to write about it on my site.
Very good. We'll keep an eye out for that on wolfstreet.com. And as we wrap up here, Wolf Richter, please tell our listeners a little bit more about all the fantastic material they can find free of charge.
So tell people more, please, about Wolf Street and all of the neat stuff they can find there.
Yeah, wolfstreet.com. So this is like my name, Wolf, and Wall Street. So wolfstreet.com, everything is free. We post about 2 or 3 articles a day, lots of charts and economic data. We stay out of politics, just business, economics, and finance.
Wolf Richter. Please return in 2018.
Yes, we're looking forward to it. Thank you.